This meeting is called to order. And Representative Mulry, would you please move approval of the minutes? Thank you. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Next, Representative Hillstrom, you will present House File 334.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 334 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. And we do have a DE1 amendment, Madam Chair. And I actually have the folks that have been negotiating the deal on this bill that I'm going to let them talk about it. But the one thing that I wanted to just say right off the bat is that, you know, one of the elements of this agreement involves updating some program names in our exemption statute. We're removing obsolete ones and adding new ones, but this is a technical change, and it is not intended to change any existing exemptions or impact any previous or future court decisions. So when they're talking about that, I just want that to be on the record. So with that, Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to Ron Elwood.
Right now. Okay. First, Representative Hillstrom, do you want to move the DE1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move the DE1 amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. To the DE1 amendment, any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and we have been, this is a, what you see in front of you is a product of 3 long years of negotiations and working very closely and actually very collegially with the creditors, collectors, and the banks to try to improve the process, the garnishment process in Minnesota, make it fairer and more useful for both creditors and debtors, to ensure that the creditors are receiving the information they need to identify whether the debts are legitimate or whether exemptions, and also to give the debtors on the other side the opportunity to assert their exemptions and protect exempt funds. So I would like to actually publicly thank Tom Hoffman, who's going to speak next. He really is the architect of this entire agreement, and he has worked tirelessly for these years and in very, very good faith, and we're really appreciative. We've been working on it for a long time, and I think this really moves the ball forward in Minnesota on this complex issue.
Thank you. Please identify yourself and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hoffman. I'm one of the in-house attorneys at Wells Fargo. And thank you, Ron. We have been working pretty hard on this for quite a while. And just as a real brief historical background of really the group, in the mid-80s, the Hennepin County Debtor-Creditor Committee went off trying to basically revise most of our collection statutes and did so. In the mid-80s, we started looking at the garnishment statute, so we've been at this for quite a while. We did a complete rewrite. I was the chair of the committee that passed in 1990. We made another huge change in 2000 of the garnishment and summary execution statute, too. And this is one of the areas that we've been discussing for quite a while, because we couldn't agree to it in those earlier changes. And they were very significant changes. So I've been working with my friends at Legal Aid for 20-plus years trying to get this right. I think now we have come to some agreement. The amount of people you're looking at is very significant, but the reason I think you're looking at a lot of pieces of paper is because as you change some of the provisions we have, especially relating to garnishing or levying a bank account, we had to change 3 different statutes. So really the language is very parallel, in fact almost exact, and that's why it looks like there's a lot more than there is. It's just why that stuff is more technical, but we needed to change the 3 statutes. The other reason it's a little bit longer is because we have statutory forms, and for 3 statutes of the statutory forms, again, it just got a lot longer. The forms themselves, as we took a look at them, we wanted to make sure and assure the debtors in the state knew what their exemptions were, are able to claim their exemptions, and try to avoid the confusion as best we could. So The forms themselves got a little bit longer, and that's why you've got so much paper there. But essentially, I'm trying to break this down, make it very simple. There's really two areas that we're looking at that I think in the state needed to be addressed, and we addressed them. One was the prejudgment garnishment area. And in Minnesota, for a number of years, we've had a provision that says that if a debtor doesn't answer a summons complaint within 40 days, and as everybody knows, 20 days is our period to answer a summons complaint in state court. But if 40 days go past, you can have a prejudgment garnishment. And for a number of years, that has been upheld by various courts. Legal Aid has been talking quite a bit about, you know, that provision and the fairness of that provision. So we dealt with that, and I'll explain that in a second. The other one is something we have euphemistically called the bank ping pong for a number of years. And what that really is, just again, to kind of shorten this whole thing, is how debtors can claim their exemptions after their bank account has been garnished or levied. So it allows, it's the process to allow a debtor to claim whatever exemptions they have in the money in a bank account. Okay? So that's cleaning up that process and try to make it, I think, more fair for debtors and for banks' interests. Again, I think it'll make life easier for us, and for creditors, I think that's the same. So basically, the one thing that, again, the prejudgment garnishment section, what we're doing is continuing to allow that to occur, but provide a notice to the debtor after the 20-day time period. Just one of the statutory forms that you're looking at. It gives debtor all the information they need, really, about what's coming. It's really the pre-notice that they're going to need. The reason that we're saying it's still good for debtors and creditors is, in Minnesota, you don't have to file your lawsuit with the clerk of court. I think, again, that saves the cost. It's cheaper for debtors because they eventually have to pay for it. It doesn't go on their credit bureau rating, and really encourages creditors and debtors to get together to talk. That's what this is all about. So what we decide to do is give them the notice that they need to have. And we think that balances things out pretty well for everybody. On the bank ping pong side, the complaint has always been that the debtors were required to put things into court if there's a dispute. Here, the creditors, we're shortening down the process. The creditors are going to be the ones who are going to have to put it into court if there's a dispute. On the flip side, the debtors are going to have to give 60 days of bank statements to creditors. That should resolve most of the complaints that we have out there. Again, the whole point of this, from legal aid side, from the bank side, even from the creditor side, is let's shorten up the process, is what we did. Get the exemptions out, let them claim the exemptions, and the creditors can shut their files down, the debtors can have their exemptions, the banks can release the money, and we can be done with it. So that's really just a very short, brief, you know, summary, I think, of the changes we made.
That's it, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Representative Maury, that's a question.
Madam Chair, not a question, a comment. It would be sure nice if we didn't have to have things work out for 25 years. It took us 25 years to work on issues. Unfortunately, for instance, I don't think the problems with the budget are going to go away for 25 years so that we can spend as much time as they spent working on this.
Any other questions for Representative Hilstrom or our testifiers? Now, there is also an oral amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, nonpartisan staff found a word that needs to be changed. So if you could turn to Mr. Gehring, that would be great.
Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair, it's just a technical oral amendment on page 28. On line 21 and line 27, to delete the term subdivision and replace it with the term clause, because there's no subdivision, it's within a clause there.
And I would move that amendment, Madam Chair. Thank you. Any discussion? Hearing none on the oral amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
With that, Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 334, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Thank you. Any further questions by the members or discussion? Okay. Is there any other testimony, anyone for or against this bill who would like to testify this morning?
That's it, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Then all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And thank you. Motion passes.
Thank you, members.
All right. Next on our agenda is a presentation from Minister of the Courts on civil penalties.
Well, yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Rodenberg. I'm a district court judge in the 5th Judicial District, currently chambered in New Ulm, Minnesota. It's a pleasure to be with you here this morning. I'm appearing in my capacity as a member of Minnesota's Judicial Council, currently serving as the vice chair of the council, and I'm going to spend a few minutes talking to the committee today about some work that's underway in the courts to try to operate as efficiently as possible and to deal with the very real financial challenges we have as a state now and in the years ahead.
Welcome to the committee, Judge Rodenberg.
Thank you. The focus of the presentation is on the Judiciary's Access and Service Delivery Initiative, or as we creatively call it, the ASD Committee. I chaired that committee beginning approximately a year ago right now, and delivered the report to the Judicial Council this summer. The report of the committee was adopted by the Judicial Council, and we're moving forward with two initiatives, the ASD 1 Committee and ASD 2 Committee, which I'll talk about later in my comments. I want to say at the outset that some of the suggestions and changes we're proposing would not be made in an ideal world where we had adequate and full funding. We recognize that we are in an environment where full funding for the courts has not been the recent history, and we understand the challenges that the legislature has before it, not just in this session, but in coming years as well. The Access and Service Delivery Committee was created under the direction of then Chief Justice Russell Anderson for the purpose of taking a look at how we could more efficiently do work for the citizens of the state of Minnesota and deliver service as expected to the citizens of the state. I'm going to try and, being of Germanic heritage, I'm impaired in my ability to operate electronic devices, so I will do my best. To put our situation in context, the judicial branch has been underfunded for at least the past 6 years. In the last recession, 2004-05, that occurred just as we were bringing the remaining districts into state funding. And we now, of course, are fully unified and we have all of the districts into state funding. At that time, there was a $23 million shortfall. There was not restoration of those cuts in 2006-07, and in the current biennium, we're dealing with another $19 million shortfall. To close the $19 million gap in this biennium, we're now operating 9% short staff. We have, of course, a staffing study that indicates the level of staffing that is appropriate to continue to do business that is, as it has historically been done in the state, and we are operating at 9% short of the staffing indicated by that study. We have done a number of things to try and cope with the challenges that we're facing with the budgetary situation. We have a voluntary separation program. We're right now in the process of working on a voluntary leave without pay program. We have done layoffs in multiple districts, and I'm sure some of you are aware of those in districts 3, 6, and perhaps others as well. We have instituted a hiring freeze, which is a very hard freeze, so positions are being kept open as employees leave. We're also holding open judge vacancies, essentially on a statewide basis at this point, in an effort to try and bridge that gap. We've also done a number of things with respect to service. Unfortunately, we've been force to close public counters a half day each week in multiple districts, the 3rd, 4th, and 10th. And I think it's fair to say that looking out, that is probably something that's going to be coming to other districts in the very near future. We did close the satellite court in Washington County.
Excuse me, Judge Roten.
Yes, Madam Chair.
By Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Judge Rotenberg. And maybe it's for Ms. DeSalle. Do you have statistics of how many filings per day are in all of the counties? In other words, you've got, for instance, the Pence is the northern suburbs, which are fairly busy. The 4th is Hennepin, which is fairly busy. I'm wondering how many hours actually per day are required in many of these counties, and whether we couldn't be, instead of, or at least instead of closing Hennepin a half day, maybe having some counties open one or two afternoons a week or something, where I'm told by attorneys in some rural counties that there's only few responses that staff have to make to customers in a day.
If I could answer,
yes.
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, you have anticipated precisely where I'm going to go with my comments over the next number of minutes. This is the very thing that we're looking at in the Access and Service Delivery Committee. I'll try and get to that point as quickly and as efficiently as I can, but I want to get to, I want to first address what we've been doing up until 2008 as a way of setting off comparison for what we're proposing to do in the future, which includes some of the very questions that you're asking, Representative. In the 4th District, we have terminated and reduced a number of programs that are very beneficial to the folks in that very busy district, as Representative Mullery correctly notes. Other service reductions that we have been compelled to institute because of the current underfunding. We reduced, this was last summer, we reduced jury per diem expenses from $20 to $10. We did that with, it pained us to do that, frankly, because the jurors coming into our courts are performing an important service, and we want to be able to compensate them adequately, but with the funding that was available, we had to do something to bridge the gap. And reduction of jury per diem was done in 2008. There have been cuts to currently operating drug courts, cuts to retired judge service, reductions of mandated services budgets, and all of this has resulted in criminal and civil case delay across the state of Minnesota. We haven't just been cutting services, but we've been aggressive in trying to find new efficiencies. Since the completion of state funding, we've developed a staffing study similar to the weighted caseload study that allows us to more objectively match staff to workload across the state. Our districts came into state funding with the budgets that they had under county funding, so that we had some counties that had sort of have counties and have not counties, and had various levels of funding. We've taken painful steps to equalize the funding allocations statewide to support our goal of the equitable delivery of justice, regardless of where you might happen to live. We flattened the management structure. Today, in 40% of our counties, we have court administrators who have the duty of court administrator in more than one county. I myself am chambered in such a county. Brown and Nicholas County currently share Carol Mellick as the court administrator, and that has flattened the management structure to save funds for the judiciary. Under state funding, we no longer have 87 different silos of budget, but we're all operating under statewide system so that we can move staff and work across county and district lines to make the most of what we have. We've structured all of our state programs to achieve improved outcomes at lower unit costs. We've implemented a statewide virtual self-help center with workstations in every county, and a toll-free helpline to specialized staff in Hennepin County servicing the state. That is noteworthy because when folks come in and need assistance and are pro se, they don't have anywhere else to go, so they end up at the counter. As I said, we're currently operating at approximately 9% short staff at those counters already, so this virtual statewide self-help center gives people a way to talk to someone who's informed and can help them with their legal needs instead of going to a counter which may or may not be open and may or may not be adequately staffed at the time they approach. We've increased telephone interpreting and tightened up jury management procedures, all to reduce costs. We've outsourced our collections function with a private vendor and have increased collections by $20 million since we started. So we've been making significant strides in maximizing the scarce resources we've been given. As I indicated at the outset, approximately 1 year ago right now, hearing warning signs of the recession that we now know is upon us, the Judicial Council, which is the administrative body for governing the judicial branch, asked State Economist Tom Stinson to come visit with us about the state's financial outlook. What he reported to us, and you've undoubtedly heard all of this as well, is that our fiscal challenges are not just short-term, but are long-term in nature and are being driven by the demographic shifts that are happening and are going to continue to happen.
Excuse me, Jeff Rotenberg, I've got a question. That is increasing use of technology, especially for recording proceedings in lieu of having a court reporter there. What's happening there?
Madam Chair, once again, you're doing an excellent job of anticipating the work that we're doing. That is something that, and I'm going to talk about this in my, it'll be on slides later, but we are doing work on redesigning and redeploying our staff in the most efficient way possible, which includes taking a look at the court reporter duties and how best to use those employees throughout the state.
Representative Jastrowski, you have a question?
I do. Thanks, Madam Chair. Judge Rotenberg, thank you for your presentation this morning. You talked about some of the staff reductions or staff hiring freeze, layoffs, voluntary leave without pay. Have you considered a salary freeze or salary reductions among staff? Have judges contributed their portion?
Madam Chair, Representative Jastrowski. I'm sorry, I'm getting your name wrong. My apologies.
Enough for today.
thank you. The original budget request by the judiciary included a judicial salary increase. That was made, of course, before the November forecast and the information that was available then, and it's going to be updated the first part of March, as I understand it. At the very first Judicial Council meeting after the November forecast was put out, the Judicial Council removed from the budget request any increase in salary for judges. So as far as we're concerned, that is a non-factor for the next 2 years. There's no request for judicial salary increases. Currently, we have our budget request does have a placeholder for staff salary increases. However, I think it's fair to say that the Judicial Council is more than interested in working with the legislature and the governor. If those same bargaining units settle at 0-0 in the executive branch, we would be very willing to go along with that notion. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to zip through these next few slides fairly quickly because I'm sure this information, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is available to you and has been all in the news and all in your consideration. But to say the least, we understand that the aging of society is going to have a significant impact on things. This is kind of a busy slide and probably indicates information with which you are already very familiar, but as working people retire, the amount of taxes that the working people pay in retirement is going to be significantly, as a percentage, significantly less than what they're paying as working folks. Retired people tend to spend less, they tend to take in less taxable income, obviously, and they live off of retirement pensions and the like, resulting in less receipts. The slide indicates that when a retired couple takes a 30% decrease in the amount of income, the respective decrease in the amounts of tax they pay could go down by 58% to 72%. That's not all. As the baby boomers are retiring, the numbers of new workers in the state is going to be shrinking, creating competition for employees like we've not seen in over 50 years. The demographer estimates that the Minnesota workforce is going to shrink over the next two decades at a rate that exceeds the national average. It's a little difficult to to wrap your mind around right in these times, but there's going to be, in coming years, increased competition for employees as the number of new workers decreases. By 2020, it's estimated that those over 65 will exceed school-age children for the first time in our history. So that leaves us with twin challenges, significant budget restraints, and that is true no matter how meritorious the needs of the judicial branch are and no matter how core a government function we may be. Those budget constraints will be occurring at the same time that we're going to be faced with a smaller available workforce or, at a minimum, significant competition for a limited pool of workers.
Excuse me, Judge Rotenberg. With the aging of the population, is it a fair assumption that senior citizens are involved in both litigation, civil or criminal matters, at a lower rate, and perhaps we can anticipate reducing caseloads in the future?
Madam Chair, I don't know that that we have that information currently available. One of the challenges we do see is with the aging population, there's going to be significantly more demand on the courts in terms of guardianship, conservatorship, and certain case types.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Judge, and Ms. DeSalle. As Chair of the Workforce Policy Committee, I've seen these same numbers on demographic changes over the next 20 years. They have indicated there will be significant competition. The sentence they finished was comparable pay increases of, in order to attract talent and keep people. I didn't see that in your slide. So how are you figuring that's going to play in? I mean, they're talking huge dollar figures in terms to attract and keep good people, whether it's in the banking, the courts, construction, farm fields, hands, everything. And I don't know if that comes into your play here or not, but I think the committee should understand the numbers that the state board is pushing out there.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's another excellent question, and some work that's being done by us here and also by the state of Utah with respect to redesigning the way that we use our employees in the court system is really going to be the key in the future. Just trying to keep the same number of employees doing the same things that they've always done is going to be tremendously costly and probably not possible. We're going to need to use technologies to decrease the overall need for a number of employees and then increase the skill set required of those employees so that they can efficiently operate the systems within the courts. We're going to have to redesign the way we do business. And again, that's precisely the work that the Access and Service Delivery Committee is suggesting. And so I'm probably spending too much time on background here, and it sounds like from the questions you want me to get into the meat of the proposals that are being made, and I'm going to do that now. As I indicated in January of 2008, approximately a year ago, the Access and Service Delivery Committee was created under the direction of then Chief Justice Russell Anderson, and the committee delivered its report in the summer of this year. We looked at evaluating options for moving forward, and we used the following criteria. What is going to be the cost impact? How much is it going to cost or save to look at a particular option? How feasible is it, both politically and otherwise? The service impact, and this gets to what Representative Mulley was asking about. What is going to be the difference in service with each change that we are considering to the public? And lastly, the time impact, which is important because we need to look at changes that can be implemented quickly and in an time-effective manner. Proposing a change that is 25 years out, for example, might not be helpful given the current environment and the problems that we're looking at. This gets precisely at what Representative Mahoney was talking about. We took a look at, by way of analogy, the banking industry. When I got my first job in about 1972 at the Kaiserhof in New Ulm, I would get paid by Hildy Lewinsky, rest her soul, who would give me a piece of paper each 2 weeks. And then I could walk down to the Farmers and Merchants Bank, which is a block away, and I could stand in line. There was about 10 counters that were filled with people, and I probably had to stand in line most of the time to wait to see one of those people to hand that piece of paper to the person to get my money in the bank. And then I had, when I wanted to get money out, I would have to go back and stand in line again and hand them a different piece of paper. Again, probably have to wait in line. In the banking industry, the way that that service is delivered today is so much different than it was in 1972. I never see my paycheck from the state of Minnesota. Thankfully, I still receive it, and it gets into my banking account, but there is no piece of paper. It's done electronically. When I left New Ulm last night to travel up here because of the early hour, I was able to take money out of the bank after normal banking hours, at the, you know, after supper in the evening, by going to the ATM machine and getting my money out to travel here today. I didn't see anyone in any of that transaction, but it worked very effectively, and it delivered the service to me without my seeing any person. We're looking at that as a kind of a model of a way to be able to deliver service to the people in the state of Minnesota using technology. The recommended options from the Access and Service Delivery Committee are these, and you see them on the screen. Staffing to the most efficient norm. I need to take just a moment to explain that. The courts have historically staffed the courthouses across the state according to the size of the courthouse. The smallest courthouses are staffed at the highest staff need per weighted caseload. For example, in my district, the smallest weighted caseload in each county would be Lincoln County, Ivanhoe, Minnesota. It's a beautiful courthouse. Fact of the matter is, as Representative Mulvery points out, the number of cases going through the Lincoln County courthouse is significantly different than in the larger counties. There's the medium-sized courts and then the large courts. And the large courts, in most instances, but not all, in most instances have the most efficiencies in terms of staffing. And that's not surprising because of the caseload and the number of files and papers moving through, they're able to obtain efficiencies. So historically, they have been staffed at less staff per weighted caseload because of those efficiencies. The norms that have historically been used are just that. They're historical. How many staff does it take to run a courthouse with 0.5 judge need? Well, you can kind of figure that out based on you're going to keep that courthouse open from 8 to 5 and you're going to do certain things. We're suggesting, and we're going to have to do this in the near future, that we staff to the most efficient norm, identify how much staff is necessary to handle cases at the most efficient level, and then staff at that level across the state, Lincoln County and Hennepin County, and then find the efficiencies in the system and ways to get at those efficiencies so that you don't have more staff per weighted caseload in Lincoln County than you do in Hennepin County.
Representative Mulvery.
Madam Chair, Judge
Rotenberg. Close enough for today.
you need a name like Smith or something. Has there been any consideration by the, and maybe again it's Ms. DeFell, consideration by the court system of working with county employees as to do, I mean, it would make much more sense when we have maybe 5 cases a day or 5 to 10 contacts for a court staff employee. Why couldn't we make an arrangement to pay a little bit of the salary of a county employee who's doing something else to do that?
Judge Rotenberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulvery. It's a pleasure to be here with a group that anticipates so precisely the things that, so precisely the things that we are looking at and talking about. Absolutely. If we're going to staff, I don't mean to keep picking on Lincoln County, but it's in my district and I'm familiar with the way it operates. So if we're going to staff Lincoln County at the same staff need per weighted caseload as Hennepin County, Lincoln County is going to end up with one employee. Now, one employee is going to take a noon break. One employee is going to take a vacation. More likely, we're going to have to move that staff and team that staff with Lyon County and move people across county lines and probably change the hours of service in Lincoln County, ultimately. We have seriously talked about, though, to get to your question, Representative Mallory, for periods of time when the staff is not available, which in the smallest counties that doubtless will be, that will be something that we have to deal with, contracting with the county recorder's office or the county auditor's office for the filing of papers. We still do need, you know, parties coming into the courthouse still need to file papers in a timely fashion. You know, statutes of limitations don't quit running because Lincoln County doesn't have a staff person right this minute. Or a filing requirement for a motion paper isn't suspended because the counter is closed. So we are seriously looking at that.
Mr. Rotenberg, now I have to remember my question. Have you considered increasing the use of referees? And the reason I ask that is in outstate Minnesota, we don't have the luxury of being able to specialize. And when, in Mille Lacs County where I practice, when we do get someone who is, say, you know, really an expert in housing or child support, we find that there's a real efficiency and actually I found the quality of justice, so to speak, to be higher. And I know that referees are paid up to 90% of judges, but, you know, that's the up to. And so I'm wondering if there's been consideration of increased use.
Madam Chair, yes. Again, we'll get to that in just a little bit. But once again, you're precisely anticipating where we're going. Use of subordinate judicial officers coupled in rural parts of the state with the use of interactive television is something that we think can and should be used in the future, and we're moving in that direction, and I will get to that. The second, the recommended options, I spent probably too much time talking about the staffing of the most efficient norm, but I wanted to take a moment to explain that we have staffed the counties historically differently based on the size so that you could understand where we're going with that. We recommend workflow reengineering in the electronic environment, and this is the subject that I was talking to Representative Mahoney about just a bit ago, and we'll go into more detail. Legislative and court policy reform and structural and governance issues. In order to staff to the most efficient norm, we're going to need to do some things and use some tools in order to allow the service to still be delivered to the citizens of those less populous counties. You can't just say, Lincoln County, you now have one employee. You have to do something more. You have to give them tools in order to be able to continue to deliver service. Of the 2 million cases that we handle in the district courts of the state of Minnesota each year, approximately 1.2 million of those are citations. Most of those citations are payables. If we considered centralizing the processing of these using specialized staff, standardizing our collections process to turn over old debt and use hearing officers for fine mitigation rather than judges, significant economies in staff and judge time can be realized. Some of these things are already being done in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. Similarly, using ITVs and ITV services and referees, we can centralize or regionalize lower-level cases, and centralize or regionalize the management of mandated services programs such as jury and interpreter services, and that's currently being done. Actually, I think Representative Jackson, Madam Chair, you're from the 7th Judicial District.
That's right.
And the 7th and the 8th have been kind of one of the models for that, of centralizing an interpreter who operates, as I understand it, from the Moorhead area, and is able to interpret for people in multiple locales throughout those two districts. If we can replicate that model throughout the state, we can save a lot of money. Interpreters traveling to the smaller counties, and depending upon the county in question, may travel to handle one or two hearings at a time. If they're traveling any distance at all and receiving the minimum, I think under most of the contracts it's 2 hours minimum, that's an awfully high cost per case when the case is a speeding ticket or the case is a driving after revocation ticket. If we can centralize that using technologies including ITV and or telephone, that we can save significant funds there.
Mm-hmm.
to divert more work from court administration staff and in order to staff to the most efficient norm. We think the statewide virtual self-help center needs to expand and be more widely promoted. I talked about that just very briefly earlier, but when folks needing self-help assistance come somewhere, they come to the window, the desk, the counter. And if that counter is not being staffed at the level that it has been historically, we need to give those people an option, and that is to call or use the website to the statewide self-help center.
Judge Rotenberg, the self-help centers also provide forums for people, and do you find that the use of sort of clear templates improves understanding of what pro se litigants are after?
Madam Chair, in response to your first question, yes, there are forms available, and there are computer terminals, I think, now in all of the 87 counties. But this is a fairly new endeavor. I can't really say anything about the understanding level or the usability because it's fairly new, and I just don't know that information. But maybe, Sue, can you help me on that?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Sue Dosal. I'm the State Court Administrator. Our online self-help center has thousands of forms, and it also increasingly has tutorials, and sometimes in more than one language, and particularly in the family area. So you can click on, and there will be a person that comes on, a little video about how you fill out this kind of a case. We have a specific application called ICANN, which has to do with dissolution that's been very helpful. We're trying to do more of that in other areas, too, to actually help people walk through the forms because, as you know, those divorce forms are, you know, 32 pages long. But it asks people questions, and then they respond to it, and they get through the whole thing, and then the form populates itself. And while it's still a long form, it's taken care of, and I think it helps tremendously, not just the pro se litigant, but the court staff, because the form is filled out correctly, and it's, you know, typed and so forth. So we're doing more in that area, but each of those is an expensive proposition. So we're doing it as we can.
Thanks.
The last bullet point is important. Redesign of the courtroom support duties. Historically, the courts have kept the record by stenographic form, and historically the courts have had at least one court administration staff in the courtroom. So with the judge, the law clerk, the court reporter, and one court administration staff, historically you're talking about a minimum of four people in the courtroom. With current technologies, that is something we're spending a lot of time and effort on, reducing the number of people in the courtroom. That's a sensitive topic, and it's not one that we're going to solve today or tomorrow, but we need to look at that and deploying our staff in the most effective and efficient way. We're looking, actually next month, we're going to Hennepin County, the committee that I'm chairing now, going forward to implement some of these changes. We're going to visit Hennepin County and their Court Smart program, whereby the use of Court Smart recording technology, one employee can monitor the record that's being made, as I understand it, in four courtrooms at a time. Now, Brown County doesn't have four courtrooms. So that's an efficiency that I probably can't attain without some additional technology. But it may well be that if we can expand the capacity of our wide area network, perhaps a court reporter can monitor Brown County and Watonwan County and Blue Earth County. And so this is something we need to look at, and we are looking at ways to redesign the courtroom support duty so that we don't have four people in every courtroom throughout the state all the time. And that's being done already. Actually, the 8th District and I think the 7th to some extent have been using electronic court reporters and obtaining some efficiencies there. Certainly the 8th, I think, is down to one stenographic court reporter. And in the case of Judge Seibel, who's also on the Judicial Council, he works in 6 different counties. They're very lightly populated areas of the state along the South Dakota border, but he takes his court reporter and staff with him so that they're staffing the courtrooms in multiple counties with the same person in multiple sites throughout not just the week, but sometimes during the same work day. We recommended to the council, and the council did adopt, workflow reengineering. Centralizing the paper processing of payables will achieve some efficiencies, but automating the process end-to-end will achieve so much more, with huge potential for cutting labor costs. We're currently in the midst of testing several pilots. We are doing this sort of on an as-we-can basis, but the potential for implementing what has been referred to by our technology people as the trifecta, e-citation, auto-assess, and interactive voice recognition, interactive web recognition, on which payment is done by phone or across the Internet, along with auto-referral, which would automatically and electronically pass old debt to our collections vendor. This could have significant payoffs in terms of cost reduction and even in improved service. Ideally, in the future, if we can get our law enforcement justice partners with us on this, the citation can be issued electronically, and the keying in of the information or the swiping in of the information off of the magnetic strip on a person's driver's license can populate the fields that are necessary for the courts to handle that matter electronically. When you get a speeding ticket, for example, in an ideal world here, once we implement all of this, you swipe the my driver's license, say I get the speeding ticket, swipe your driver's license through the squad car reader, and it populates the field for law enforcement, and that is then electronically transmitted to the court, so we don't have to key that same information again as we do currently. If the individual would want to pay that by phone or web, the individual could pay it from their own home without coming to the courthouse and without using any paper, kind of like my paycheck is now handled from the state of Minnesota. And it could be paid electronically and the file closed, ideally, without ever anybody handling the matter. Now remember, 1.2 million of the 2 million cases are citations. A large percentage of those, if we can implement this system, can be handled without any hands-on work in the courts. But we have to work with our justice partners. I mean, we can't just declare this. We have to work with law enforcement. We have to work with county and city attorneys to get to these places in the future.
And Judge Rotenberg, has that conversation begun?
Absolutely. It has begun. In fact, I was with the Supreme Court Justice Barry Anderson and I were with the city attorneys at their annual conference last week on Friday, and we have begun the discussions. To say the least, there are concerns on the part of multiple players in the system, but the discussion is definitely underway.
Thank you. Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, for the judge, on that point and another point, why not go as far as, if the people don't dispute the issue, the speeding ticket, why not just let them pay it on the site and move on, close the file right there? Takes it out of just about all the work out of your hands. Related to this issue, why are we still going through with cities sending all their dog tag violations or their dog roaming tickets up through the court system when they could handle these administratively locally and save the time that takes? Situation, the city imposes a $50 dog roaming violation, and by the time it gets done with the courts, the residents have a $135 bill because we add surcharges on in the courts process. And why even waste people's time with that process? Unless they want to challenge it, there can easily be an appeal process set up, then they pay the additional fee, those two issues. So what's being discussed in that type of, both in the speeding tickets and maybe ways to reduce what comes through your doors in the first place?
Madam Chair and Representative, I have not heard of any conversations about paying in the squad car. There may be issues attendant to that. One thing that does need to happen is that the court system has been the keeper of the record of those convictions. And so when a person gets a driving after revocation ticket, for example, the MNCIS system ends up being the repository for that information. It needs to flow through our system ultimately. As to paying it in the squad car, I've not heard that option, but I suppose it's worth considering. As to these lower level tickets, I'm going to talk about in a little bit the expansion of the payables list to allow more of those to be handled as payables. I do know that there are a number of jurisdictions currently that are doing administrative tickets. The council has taken no position on any of that. The council has not taken a position on administrative tickets. The third recommendation is that legislative and court policy reform.
Excuse me, Judge Rosenberg.
Yes, Madam
Representative Chair. Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Rosenberg, you said the council hasn't taken a position on administrative tickets. I thought was it DPS or the judicial system or there was very strongly opposed when the cities came in and wanted to do administrative tickets and fines.
Madam Chair,
I believe
the Attorney General's office has taken a position with regard to that, and the position taken, as I understand it, by the Attorney General's office is that it's not permissible.
Right, and then, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Judge Rosenberg, then the cities were coming, came forward with a bill in the former committee that Representative Hillstrom had, and it came to our committee also, and there was no solution that we had, but I think, as I recall, I don't think the Attorney General, they issued their opinion. But lobbying over here, I know, I'm sure, was DPS, and I thought the courts were, but maybe not. So the courts weren't involved at all. They don't take a position.
Judge Rosenberg? Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulray, I can't speak for whether there may have been people within the judicial system having conversations. There may have been, but the Judicial Council, which is the governing body, has not taken any position, and that's my understanding of the history. The ASD committee did recognize and recommend that legislative and court policy reform should also be considered, aimed at reducing our workload. If the courts can't be funded to handle all of the work previously assigned to the court, then something has to be done to reduce the workload. In terms of numbers and priority, there are hundreds of thousands of lower level criminal cases that are a target area. Workloads for the courts and public defenders can be reduced by legislatively making lower level misdemeanors, civil infractions, and or putting more misdemeanors on the payables list and making them payable tickets. Given the potential cuts to the court, we are recommending that the legislature consider the concept contained in the 1995 NEAC report, which is the Non-Felony Enforcement Advisory Committee, which was so capably chaired by Ms. LaSalle, who's to my right. Making more offenses payable petty misdemeanors or civil infractions would eliminate mandatory court appearances and would also eliminate the right to public defender for indigent individuals and the right to a jury trial and these costs. By way of example, misdemeanor offenses currently are allowed by the legislature and by the law for ordinance violations. Going back to the representative's question, the roaming dog case may well be defined by the city council, by city ordinance, as being a misdemeanor because it carries the possibility of time in jail. A person appearing in my court has a right to request the services of a public defender, and unless it's certified as a petty or something that's worked out, they have the right to a jury trial. Making more of those matters civil infractions or petty misdemeanors is a way to eliminate not just the demand on the courts, but also the demand on public defender, and their budget is similarly under stress, and also to reduce demand for jury services.
So, Judge Rotenberg, would it then also reduce the caseload for the prosecutors?
Madam Chair, I believe that would be true.
All right.
And we recognize, if I could take a little bit of a detour with respect to our current budget request, we recognize that we are not going to be able to fill judgeships at the same rate as we have in the past. I think the weighted caseload numbers currently are 9. Is that the correct? 12. I guess the weighted caseload numbers now indicate that we should be requesting 12 more judges if we were going to do things the way we've always done them. As I said a little bit ago, we're currently not asking for any additional judgeships. We're in fact holding judgeships open as a money-saving way, as a way to save money. If we're going to reduce our requirements for future judicial need, these are some of the things we're going to have to do. We're not asking for 12 new judges. We know we can't get 12 new judges, but if we're not going to get them, then we've got to figure out ways to do the business without involving judges, and that's just one more thing that expansion of payables and these sorts of changes.
Representative Weston, did you have a question?
Well, just a clarification, I appreciate what the judge said. The scenario I was in was a petty misdemeanor scenario, and the city, when I got involved in it, said, well, this is the process we have to go through. We can't do it any other way, and so it wasn't even a misdemeanor scenario, but I'm glad to hear what you're talking about, because I think sometimes we need to just simplify how people can resolve this stuff and not just pile big fines and big processes up when they just want to resolve it.
Representative Mallory.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman, and Judge Rotenberg. I guess what I'm worried about is we're down to half hour now left, and my understanding was most of the presentation was going to be on the changes to the public from a number of these things, and part of these things will be affecting Representative Hellstrom's committee, and a lot of these affect both, because if you take it out of the criminal part and put it into civil, both committees are affected. So there's a lot of issues that I've heard about that are quite changing the way we do things, so I'd like to have you spend some time on those, because I think that was one major reason why we wanted to have this presentation. If there's a lot of changes that are going to be made, making things civil instead of criminal, or a civil sanction instead of a criminal type sanction. So if you could make sure that we get into that.
Judge Rotenberg.
Thank you. I'll try and keep moving through it with those comments in mind. The ASD committee does recommend, and the council has adopted, expansion of the payables list. To deal with the current underfunding, in December, the Judicial Council expanded the payables list, eliminating 100,000 or more mandatory court appearances to reduce court and public defense workload. Some of the examples of what we're going to make payable are going to include driving after revocation tickets, for example, that would be a payable offense under the expanded payables list. Under the current plan, driving without proof of insurance would become a payable offense as of July 1st of this year. Now, some of these recommendations would not be made by the Judicial Council but for the magnitude of the cuts being proposed for the courts and public defense this biennium, coupled with the long-term fiscal constraints we face in future years from the future demographic shifts. If we can make more of those cases payables, they will be handled without any court appearance, without any public defender, and at decreased expense to the judicial and other systems generally. So that is underway currently, and the expansion of the payables list has been done. Finally, ASD recommended looking at some of what we do, especially...
Representative Johnson, I believe, first, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, on the issue you're talking about, Judge, have you had much pushback in opposition to it, and if so, from whom?
Madam Chair, Representative? Yes. the city attorneys have concerns. Law enforcement has concerns. And those things are the subject of ongoing discussions. The pushback, I would also say, has been more in the rural parts of the state than in the metro area. I think there are some areas of the metro area that are currently handling many of what we're designating now as payable statewide. They've already been handling them as payable, Hennepin County most notably. So I think there's less pushback in those areas that have already done some of these things, and we're proposing to take statewide things that have already been done. Does that answer the question?
Thank you.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Judge Rotenberg, just a question on, if you take them and make them payable, what does that affect the revocations, et cetera, that are now occurring under DPS and other rules somewhere?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I correctly understand your question, but when they pay it, it is a plea of guilty.
Okay.
So that when it's paid, the record will show that that's a plea of guilty and a conviction the same as it always would have.
Quick follow-up. In other words, what the DPS does or the driver motor vehicle department does won't change just because you made it payable.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative, I believe that that is correct. Now, in Hennepin County, there is a no proof of insurance pilot that's been done by the Department of Vehicle Services to have officers issue warnings instead of tickets, giving the individual 10 days to show up at the DVS station to show proof of insurance, and that will close the case. 75% of no proof of insurance citations in Hennepin County are dismissed when people come in and bring proof. They have insurance. They just didn't have the proof of insurance in the car. The system that we have in place currently with the issuance of citations for those cases has resulted in a lot of paper being filed with the courts, which is really unnecessary and is really no longer affordable in the current economic environment. Invoking the whole adversary process when all you really were talking about was I didn't have the current card in my car is something that we think needs to be handled more efficiently.
I've encouraged the members of the committee to check the glove compartments because I did and mine was 2 years old.
Madam Chair, I just acquired a new vehicle in my effort to help the economy, and when I cleaned out the glove compartment, I found insurance cards going back 4 years, and so now I do have the current one, though. ASC committee in the council has moved forward sort of with two different committees now. We're so creative. We've named them ASD 1 and ASD 2.
Wow.
The ASD 1 work group, which is being chaired by Judge Lucy Wheeland of Hennepin County, has been assigned the near-term initiatives. The first phase and number one priority is centralizing and automating the processing of payable offenses, which is key to reaching the goal of staffing to the most efficient norm. These things go together. If we're going to staff at the most efficient norm, then we have to take some of the work out of those smaller counties. And the way we will do that is by centralizing the processing of payable, centralizing or regionalizing. We're just working on it now, and Judge Wheeland is chairing the group. But instead of processing payables in 87 or more locations, we're going to process them in 1 or 10 locations, district or central. Last month, the Judicial Council gave specific and strong support for the work plan to do this, which calls for centralizing the processing of citations in the 9 largest counties by the end of 2009, and that represents 850,000 of the 1.2 million payable citations. And then we would pick up the remaining counties in the next phase. It makes more sense to try and centralize the largest areas first. In addition, we've prioritized in-court updating. And while it doesn't save us much time in the way of FTEs, it does reduce redundant clerical work, improves data quality, and passes information in real time. In my courtroom, for example, I don't have in-court updating now. My courtroom staff is making notations of what needs to be put into the Minsis system, and then at the end of the calendar, someone has to go back into a back office and enter that information into Minsis. If we can enter that information in the courtroom, which requires the making of some changes in the way we do business, you don't have to do it in the back office, but even more importantly, our data quality is better. If I issue a warrant, the warrant is, or quash a warrant for that matter, the Minsis system updates it, would update it immediately and not back in the back room when someone would finally get to it. That would be a way in which we could deliver better service to the public. If the person should be arrested, law enforcement should know about that right away. If the person shouldn't be arrested, then we should get that warrant taken back as soon as we can. And so in-court updating is something that we think will improve data quality and will allow us to inform our justice partners in real time.
Judge Rothenberg, is some of the rural objection to the payable increased payables, I just want to know if it's consistent with one email I got from my town cop, which was that there's a loss of discretion then in reducing the payables, and it's a flat fee, that's it. And that it may, if there's a $300 fine, it might actually encourage someone to attempt to challenge it rather than just pay it, because $300 is a lot of money.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I understand the question. I think I understand in the rural areas, and in my area, that this has been one of the objections, is the loss of a probationary sentence or the loss of an incarceration possibility for some of those tickets. In a rural area, you see the same person. I understand what law enforcement is saying. I gave the person the driving after revocation ticket last week. I gave him one on Monday. Now it's Wednesday, and I'm giving him another one. If those are payable, there's a loss of the option of an incarceration or a more significant sanction. That's what I understand to be the kickback.
Okay, thank you.
The fourth recommendation deals with structural and governance issues. We're looking at reducing the number of judicial districts from 10 to some smaller number, either through administrative combinations or perhaps with actual changes of the district boundaries to reduce the number of judicial districts.
Representative Murray.
Well, Madam Chair, we're getting down to 15 minutes now, and we're really, you're tending off into the finance division's issues, and there's a lot of issues that haven't been touched that are really important to this committee. You've got here eliminating civil jury trials. I didn't even know that was possible under common law. Mm-hmm. Eliminating some civil case types. What's that about? Increased use of private courts. Pay executive branch agencies to operate ITV remote facilities. That's an interesting thing. Another thing that's maybe not directly in this committee, but eliminate the right to a jury trial for misdemeanors are... Don't some of these, for instance, require legislation? Can they? Where are we going on these?
Madam Chair, Representative Mulry, can I ask you what you're reading from? I don't intend to.
What I was handed by.
I don't intend to. Oh.
Within our Access and Service Delivery Committee report to Judicial Council 2008.
There are a number of, Madam Chair, Representative Mulry, there are a number of things that are included in the attachment which were considered by the committee and not suggested.
Oh.
And it looks, sounds to me like you're reading from a list of things that I'm not going to talk about because they weren't suggested.
Representative Johnson?
Just a clarification from a previous part of the discussion we're having, that is, would any of the violations on the payable list result in someone losing their driver's license by paying the fine and pleading guilty?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. That is one significant concern. The no insurance and no proof of insurance is treated administratively, as I understand it, and that's someone else that takes care of that. That's the Vehicle Services and Department of Public Safety. But my understanding is that when there's a paid fine in certain of these areas, no insurance being one of them, that the administrative agencies take the position that that results in a suspension or revocation of license. Yes.
Judge Rotenberg, would there be any... I realize that there can be a written warning, but does that suffice to give notice to someone of the possible consequences of paying the fine and thereby pleading guilty?
Madam Chair, if I can just say, as I indicated a couple times, and I will say again now, were it the case that we had full funding and that we were moving into the future secure in the knowledge that we could continue to do business the way we are always had, we would be more than happy to do that. We're only about, $60 million away from that right now. Right now, up until the first of the year, I have historically handled those cases by in cooperation with prosecutors, where they'll agree with it, and they often do, they're reasonable people, staying adjudication for people so that you could impose a sanction and avoid the adjudication on their license. Frankly, that is an option that once we add them to the payables list and people pay them, that option is going to go away. And so we have to acknowledge and recognize that when we change the way we deliver services, there are going to be changes in the way that people interact with the system. That is true.
Thank you.
In terms of combining it, districts administrator, oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to mention, Madam Chair, to that point, when the Judicial Council put out its recommendations for expanded table list last fall, and to the entire criminal justice community, we got a lot of comment back about the expansion of this. And as Judge Rodenberg indicated, we're expanding to the state things that were already on the payables list in the metropolitan area. But one of the concerns that came back from the city attorneys was this very thing, that particularly with no proof of insurance, when you know, if an individual paid the ticket, they thought it would go away. And then they're going to get hit with a suspension of the driver's license. And it was that reason why the council deferred till July 1 the addition of no proof of insurance. And we spoke with the Department of Public Safety, who agreed to step up to the plate and in Hennepin County do a pilot test of this issue that Judge Rodenberg spoke about earlier. That is, that instead of issuing a ticket, they'd issue the warning, and then the individual could take the proof of insurance. And that's what we're testing now in this six-month period, because we do think that's a collateral consequence that, you know, we should be concerned about. My understanding was that a number of years ago, that used to be the practice. That was the practice. You'd issue these, you know, these tickets, and you could have time or warnings, you could come in. And I believe that that was changed either legislatively or some other way along over time. And so now we have all of those tickets, thousands and thousands of these tickets coming to the court, having to have people come down to the court just to show their proof of insurance. So we're trying to figure out a way to avoid that collateral consequence, avoid all of the inefficiencies in the system, and ultimately recognize that if you don't have enough money to fund all of the things that we're doing right now, you have to make some hard choices. We have to do some things different. We're going to have to stop doing some things. And this is just a part of it. And it's going to get worse.
Thank you.
We see the budget cuts coming.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And either one. couldn't we actually, on those kinds of things where we're basically taking them into civil administrative type of things, in Hennepin County we already have the, and I don't know if they're court officers or what they are down on the first floor, but they have a lot of, they're not just payable people where you either pay or you don't pay. You go in and they can negotiate with you, and they can, they have a lot of discretion. Couldn't we even give them the power to stay something?
Judge Rodenberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, that is the third bullet point here, which is expanding the use of hearing officers on those low-level cases, much the same as Hennepin and Ramsey counties currently do. I had a calendar yesterday which consisted of, 30 or 40 people coming in for that very thing, which was really fine mitigation. They agreed they didn't have tabs on their car. But the reason they didn't have tabs on their car was, you know, they and their wife separated and the vehicle was in the wife's name, and so that she got the notice, but because they weren't getting along, she didn't give him the tab thing and he didn't think about it, and consequently he got the ticket, and so he just wants to explain that to someone. Those kind of things are handled in the metro area by the very officers you're talking about, and our recommendation is very strongly that we do that on an expanded basis. When you take that to rural parts of the state, as I indicated just in brief passing earlier, you either have to use some technologies in terms of ITV or telephone hearings, or there is another alternative that's been developed by the state of Washington and that we're seriously taking a look at, and that is the fine mitigation online. If people want to just explain that, and they don't want to go to the courthouse, they just want to tell someone that that's what happened so that they can get a fine mitigation or stay of adjudication, that can be done by online. We need to do some work on that. We can't turn that on this afternoon either. But it may be that in that area, that's one where the person wants to plead guilty and just wants to give the explanation for fine mitigation purposes. The service we deliver might not only not be worse, it might actually be better, because the person doesn't need to come down to the courthouse. They can do it online in the evening when they're not working, and someone can respond to them electronically and stay adjudication or reduce the fine.
Judge
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were just discussing here at the table the possibility of, you know, the law that says, well, that you have to carry the proof of insurance with you. If there's a way that since the squad cars are equipped with electronics, they could, if someone says they're insured through State Farm, could they click into the State Farm database and collect that information there to see if they do have valid insurance?
Madam Chair, Representative, currently it's my understanding, and this is done by staff throughout the state, they've been making telephone calls to the agent is what's currently done. Now, can that be improved upon? I think that's probably possible. But again, we're already 9% understaffed currently, and we've been calling on our staff to be making phone calls to State Farm, because that's the example you used, to try and figure out if there is insurance or isn't insurance, because people do lose those cards. I mean, the fact of the matter is, people do come to the window and say, my agent is Agent Smith, but I don't know what happened to the card, but if you'll call him, he'll tell you I have insurance.
Representative Mullery?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Rotenberg, says how much of this needs legislation? In other words, to change something from a misdemeanor to a petty, I would assume requires legislation. Don't we have to be the ones that determine the max? I know you can set the sentence, which in automatically becomes what it's classified as under Minnesota law, but I'm just wondering.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, we can do some of these things ourselves by expansion of payables, but there are some things that are going to require legislative changes in what we're recommending.
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Judge. Just to follow up, I'm not sure if you caught what I was saying or not, but this would alleviate the need for a phone call. It would be the cop on the scene could access the State Farm database, in this case, to see if those persons were insured or not. It would all be done on the scene without any phone calls made.
Madam Chair?
Actually, I've been looking into this, and it is actually done by a number of states, and usually the way they fund that, it will take a number of millions of dollars of investment, and usually the way they fund that is on a fee on the insurance. So it's the insurance companies who are funding the database, and then the squad cars are able to access it. And so we would have to either have some money or find a funding source in order to do that.
Thank you, Representative Silstrom. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I've been attending the Hennepin County meetings on that, and that's exactly the problem, is the insurance companies are fighting very hard for us to do that. Otherwise, it would be easily feasible. We've talked to the prosecutors. Everybody's happy with doing that, but the insurance companies.
Judge Rotenberg, we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left.
Yeah, if I can try and bring it home here. Within the last bullet point, I also want to make brief mention of expansion of the use of hearing officers on low-level cases would not be limited to just citations. Hennepin and Ramsey counties, I believe, are using hearing officers for conciliation court matters very effectively and efficiently. As you indicated, use of people with expertise or familiarity with a particular point of law outstate may be a way not only to reduce costs but to increase service. Probate would be an area as an example. Frankly, I don't know much about probate, but I'm a district court judge, and consequently, probate comes before me. Frankly, if you could have a probate expert handle matters, you could perhaps save some money, but you could doubtless find someone who knows more about probate than me. So we are recommending and are going to be moving in that direction.
And Judge Rotenberg, could you see the possibility of someone who is, you know, like the traveling housing person, and so you would know one day per week anything from post-foreclosure landlord tenant could be heard by someone with an expertise in the area, and they would simply travel?
Yes, absolutely. And or use of ITV. It may be that the person doesn't need to travel. Some of the probate hearings are quite short. Whether a person needs to actually travel to Ivanhoe to hear the one hearing is, you know, maybe you need to travel. Maybe we need to expand the use of ITV so that that hearing can be held with an expert who's in Mankato or in Worthington and can hear matters in Pipestone or in Ivanhoe.
Oh, Judge Rotenberg, where you've had a lower-level magistrate here in conciliation court, do you know if there's been any increase in appeals for a trial de novo in those cases? Or are people just satisfied with their conciliation court judgment?
I don't know that there has been, but I guess I can't assure you that there hasn't been either. I'm not aware that there's any greater appeal.
Ms. Bissell.
Madam Chair, we've used per diem attorneys for as officers in Hennepin for years. And so I don't know. I can't go back that far to see when the change was made. But I do not believe so. They have some specialized training, and we have evaluation of the of these per diem attorneys and their work, so we know when people come before them what kind of complaints that they have. So
thank you, Mr. Representative Miller.
Madam Chair, I've been part of that for I think back into the 70s easily. And very few, at least that I remember historically, the records, and I haven't looked recent years, were very few were appealed to the court.
And Ms. Dossel, do you think a large percentage of conciliation court are debtor creditors for the smaller amounts?
Madam Chair, as you know, the jurisdiction is up to 7,500.
Right.
So we have some amazingly different complex things that are in there, but there's also a lot of very low levels.
Is there a possibility that there could even, you could have a debtor creditor, you know, specialist attorney with the proper training handle that section? I mean, any reason it can't be split up?
I would, Madam Chair, very possibly. Kind of as with probate, I think if there are a sufficient number of cases to warrant someone with specialized knowledge or experience, that would make sense as a way to handle those matters. I do want to kind of, and I know we're running out of time, I do want to talk about some of the longer-term priorities that are being studied and looked at for implementation by my continuing group, the ASD2 group. We talked about this a little bit earlier. That is re-engineering of the courtroom and judicial staff duties in support of staffing the smaller courthouses to the most efficient norm. You know, in the early going, we looked at closing court locations. I don't know if members of this committee were familiar with that. There was actually a bit of a furor last year about this time when we even talked about that notion of closing court locations. We asked the question. We have to ask those questions. It was determined that staffing to the most efficient norm actually saves more money statewide than closing some isolated locations because you still have the people, you know. If you close the courthouse in Ivanhoe, I keep picking on Ivanhoe, but if you close the courthouse there, the law enforcement officers presumably are still going to issue tickets. The people in Ivanhoe are still going to, landlords are still going to want unlawful detainer actions heard. Husbands and wives aren't going to miraculously never get divorced. You've got to have those cases handled anyway. So the closing the location doesn't help. Staffing to the most efficient norm is a much more efficient way and a much better way to get at dollars. But in order to do that, we're going to have to re-engineer the duties in the courtroom. Instead of always having four people in each and every courtroom, we're going to have to find ways, and we are looking at that, of having less people in the courtroom by having not only electronic reporting as a possibility, but also having the judge unit, that is the court reporter and the law clerk, assisting in other courtroom duties. It is often the case, by way of personal and somewhat unrelated example, in our courthouse we have seven court administration staff. It happens that two of them have fallen on ice this winter. One broke a finger and one the other day broke a hip. So we have to use courtroom staff, or my staff, to help with some of those duties. But I'm seeing it can be done. My law clerk can as easily swear a witness as a court administrator. And we can find some efficiencies there. We don't want everyone to break their hip to find them, but there are ways to find efficiencies in the system, and we're looking at that very aggressively.
Judge Rotenberg, we're about out of time. I'll give you this, maybe 30 seconds to wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're expanding the use of subordinate judicial officers, which I've already talked about. The structural and governance issues being from the 7th District, you know that the 7th and 8th are able to share a district administrator, and as far as I know, they not only haven't suffered at all, I think those are two of the better-run districts in the state.
As I understand, that they're in the black, and that makes them a minority.
They're doing a fine job. I'll put in a plug for Tim Osby, who does a wonderful job as district administrator. But that can be expanded elsewhere through the state. We don't probably need the entire district structure in all of those 10 districts. We can either combine them by redrawing the lines, or we can combine district administration positions. And lastly, and this gets to something that Representative Mulley talked about earlier, and that is that some of these things are going to require legislative and court policy reform. To the extent that there should be legislative changes to accommodate these things, they have to be well thought out. We have to be reasoned in our approach to them, and that's not something that's going to happen this session, but we're going to be looking at that moving forward and making suggestions for legislative reform to reduce the demands on the court staff and on the courts. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I don't know if that was 30 seconds, but it wasn't too much more than that. If I can be of further assistance by answering questions, I would be glad to do so.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, and this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.